another episode of The Comic Source. I'm Jace.
And I'm Jaden.
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the news this week. So the first item that I want to mention is finally, after a long 7-year wait, Captain America White is finally going to be hitting the stands in September with 2 issues. I guess they're putting out 2 issues in September to make up for the fact that it was supposed to come out 7 years ago in 2008. I will say that the timing seems a little strange. I suppose no reason to put it off any longer. But the fact that Captain America right now is Sam Wilson, used to be known as the Falcon. He's actually a black character. Meanwhile, there's all these racial tensions, black versus white. I don't know. It just seems a little weird. I know that's not Marvel's intention, but Captain America White, it's like trying to rub everybody's nose in the fact that he's a white guy. I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Yeah. A little strange on the timing, as I said. But this continues the long streak of critically acclaimed stories by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, Spider-Man Blue, Daredevil Yellow, Hulk Gray. Of course, their first collaboration was Batman Along Halloween way back in the day for DC. They're always well-received and critically acclaimed, so I imagine Captain America White will be the same. I do know that they normally tell tales of, I guess, the early days of the heroes, when they first got their powers, kind of a throwback kind of a thing. So according to the solicitations that we've seen for the first 2 issues of Captain America White, they're telling a tale of a mission, Captain America, Bucky, and the Howling Commandos. So perhaps that has a little more to do with the timing, why Marvel finally got this project completed, and it's going to see the light of day, being that, at least on the movie side of things, Captain America is still Steve Rogers. We saw the Howling Commandos in the first Captain America movie, Bucky, obviously, in the first movie, and then his return as the Winter Soldier, so.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. Even though it's been 7 years in waiting, I feel like it is one of those things that's like they're pulling him back because he hasn't. They're trying to bring it for the people who want him as Captain America. They want their original Captain America. So, in a time right now where the main Captain America isn't him, so it's. I feel like that might be a selling point of it, but it's interesting. I'm interested to see Jeff Loeb. I like him as a writer and. The art looks interesting, so.
Yeah, you know, when these projects that are rumored to come out or they make these announcements, oh, you know, this certain creative team or that other creative team on this book, and then they take years and years and years to come out, I almost feel like there isn't really a reason why they finally do come out at the time they do. It's just, you know, a lot of times it's because one or the other or both of the creators are just super busy. Sometimes they move on to movies, and that's where their focus is, or television, and that's where their focus is, rather than comics. Sometimes they move on to working on video games. And so when one of these projects finally does see the light of day, I don't know that there's any one reason you can point to. Maybe it's just a matter of they finally had time to finish it. I don't know that's necessarily the companies, you know, that's Marvel or whoever that that are making the decision. Once in a while, there are projects that are announced that actually get completed by the creators involved, and for whatever reason, they're never released and they're just stuck in a drawer somewhere. And so that's a little more having to do with the timing as far as the publishers are concerned, but I don't know that that's necessarily the case here. Anyway, moving on, another big item of news this week was DeviantArt has pulled its sponsorship of Artist Alley at San Diego Comic-Con. This is kind of big news. For those of you that aren't aware, a couple years ago, Artist Alley in San Diego, well, it's been shrinking probably for the past, I don't know, 7 years or so, pretty much at the same time that San Diego Comic-Con started to explode in popularity. started being sold out within minutes of the badges going on sale. You know, more and more Hollywood studios wanted to show up and exhibit there, and space on the exhibit floor really started to become a premium. And being that the artists don't pay for their spot, they don't have to pay for their table, they really started to kind of feel squeezed and maybe even a little taken for granted. They're shoved all the way off to one side. Artist Alley kind of shrank some. Their tables got smaller, had a hard time getting hold of chairs. There was no carpeting on the floor. Things were pretty bleak. They didn't look too good. You heard a lot of artists complaining about the way they were treated. And I don't want to badmouth San Diego Comic-Con, the organizers. It's an incredible job they do, a very thankless job, a very hard job. It's hard to coordinate. I mean, when you have 100,000 plus people, descending upon the convention center, and to keep all, everything running smoothly, it's very overwhelming. So a few years ago, DeviantArt stepped in, and they were able to provide some lush carpeting, and made sure everybody had seats, made sure there was refreshments, water, and what have you, and really kind of turned things around, made the artists feel appreciated, and it was a really great thing that they did. DeviantArt also reached out to Clydene Nee. She's kind of the head honcho there in Artist Alley, the head volunteer. And when she was diagnosed with some health issues last year, DeviantArt stepped up and started a GoFundMe for her. And just, the community of artists really came together to help out Clydene in her time of need. So that was another great thing to see. So I was very surprised when I heard that they weren't going to be sponsoring Artist Alley this year, and they kind of pulled out at kind of the last minute. But basically what happened was John Waddles, the advisor-in-chief of DeviantArt, issued a statement saying that they're having a very active year, unusually so. They have a new mobile app they're working on. They're working on an entirely new modern branding. And with all these other things that they were working on for their site and with the app, being that San Diego was such a huge commitment for them, they just didn't have the time to focus on that when they had all these other things going on. The last few years when they've sponsored, they've had a pretty decent sized chunk of Artist Alley kind of off to the back and off to the side, where they had different demos and places where you could go and draw on the tablets like the artists do and kind of check things out. So I guess from a positive point of view, there'll be room for a few more artists this year without the DeviantArt people taking up that space. But it's kind of left San Diego in a lurch. There was concern that perhaps they would move Artist Alley to a different location. It wouldn't necessarily be on the exhibit floor. San Diego has since come out and said that they're not going to be doing that, that they remain committed to Artist Alley, which is, obviously good news, because I have a real hard time when artists feel like they're being marginalized by the convention. If it wasn't for these artists and these creators, a lot of them who exhibit in Artist Alley and have tables there to meet their fans and such, there would be no San Diego Comic-Con. Without these creators, there would be no comic properties and there would be no San Diego. And that's just the bottom line. You see them, pushed off to the side and feel like they're not appreciated really doesn't sit well with me. So it's very unfortunate that DeviantArt pulled out at such a late date. Perhaps if they'd been able to let San Diego Comic-Con know sooner, that it would have given more opportunity for somebody else to step in. Maybe they were still trying to make it work somehow, and just, at the last minute they just realized, hey, this is just not going to be able to happen this year. So while San Diego has come out and said they're going to keep them on the main floor, I worry for the future if it doesn't get a sponsorship. They've also said that this sponsorship by DeviantArt has helped them defray some of the costs of putting on the Artist Alley. That, to me, that seems like some doublespeak there, because you can't tell me that, San Diego's Comic-Con International is a nonprofit. right? They're charging tons and tons and tons of money to some of these studios and, you know, TV networks and such for exhibiting on the floor. You can't tell me they can't afford to keep the artist on there. What's more likely is they say, well, look, this is premium prime real estate. And if we don't have somebody sponsoring it like DeviantArt, then we're giving away this whatever X amount of feet worth of area that we're not getting any money for. And granted, it is expensive for them to put on the convention. But I gotta imagine with the way ticket prices, badge prices have gone up in a few years, with what they get for, you know, exhibitors and such, that they're not hurting. Yes, they would like to have income from that square footage that Artist Alley takes up, and that's why they would like a sponsor for it. But if they don't, I think they can certainly afford to keep it there.
No, definitely.
But I will say this, if one of these big movie studios or television networks or such that are really capitalizing on the popularity of comic book properties in mass media these days, if they were to step up, kind of swoop in at the last minute and sponsor Artist Alley, I mean, that's a lot of free advertising, you know, giant banners, you know, with whatever, you know, Sony or, you know, Warner Brothers or what have you.
So
if they were to step, I mean, that's going to generate, first of all, you're going to get a lot of great publicity. You're going to be seen as kind of the, you know, the hero that rode in, you know, at the last minute to kind of save the day. And, you know, it's all that branding. It's all that goodwill. They're certainly making tons of money off the movies, the properties, you know, whether it's, you know, Warner Brothers putting these TV shows out, or if it's, you know, Fox having the X-Men movies do well and Gotham on their network, you know, whatever it is, it would certainly generate a lot of goodwill, a lot of free publicity. So I really hope that somebody steps in, if not this year, then certainly next year. Although, for all we know, DeviantArt is going to be back next year. So.
Yeah. I can't really blame them for pulling out. I mean, I could definitely see that they're trying to focus on other things. I mean, it's pretty terrible trying to look something up on DeviantArt on your phone. It's like one of the mobile areas, one of the most vastly expanding areas, and DeviantArt's really lacking in that area. And I could see them doing this, but I don't think that it should have been this late. I think that they should have decided something a lot sooner in the year, because now it kind of puts them in a pickle. And like you said, that's really prime real estate. And I mean, that the Artist Alley there is so small already compared to a lot of other cons that hopefully somebody else picks it up. And I would be surprised if nobody else does. I mean, like you said, it's a lot of good advertising, and the person who came in would seem like a hero. And like it says on the end of this article, they could also try for a discount.
Yeah. And like you said, Artist Alley, I mean, there's a lot of other shows that have more artists, you know, and we could debate that, you know, they kind of limit it. Like I said, they don't charge, but it's a, you know, limited amount of space. And the big thing that creators have complained about over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years is just how crowded it is, you know, they're really squeezed together. You know, there used to be more artists and they used to have more space. Now with the same amount of artists, but with just less space. And so they're really crammed in there to the point where some artists, instead of taking the free table in Artist Alley, they'll, you know, team up with 3 or 4 other artists and they'll go ahead and buy some space. You know, near Artist Alley, where they can have a little more space, a little more freedom. And the other thing is they don't necessarily have to worry about being at their table. Because another thing that San Diego has done over the past few years is they kind of have some volunteers that, you know, are in that area that it's their job to work the Artist Alley and take care of the artists. They take note if an artist never happens to be at their table. You know, here they have their table for free. There's a long waiting list of people that want to get in to San Diego. And if that artist is hardly ever at their table, next year they might not be offered a table.
Yeah.
Which I can see it both ways. You know, if you're a really popular creator and you have to go work, do some signings and such at, you know, your publisher's booth, you have panels to do, you know, I can understand. But at the same time, I can also understand some of the people that are trying to get in that will be at their table, you know, wanting that spot. So, you know, you have to strike that balance.
Mm-hmm.
And we should say that for those of you that aren't familiar with DeviantArt, it's DeviantArt.com, and it's basically kind of like a Facebook for artists almost. You can showcase your work. You don't have to be an artist to go. I have a DeviantArt. You know, I go, I sign in. I can look at other people's art. I can communicate with artists on there. It's really a great tool for artists, a way to network and get your art out there, especially when you're starting out in the industry and not a lot of people have seen your art and such. So it's really a great site. I'm a big fan of it. Before I go to a convention, and when I go through the list of Artist Alley, if there's an artist that I'm not familiar with and I want to see what their work looks like, one of the first things I'll do is I'll Google their name with the word DeviantArt after to see if they have a DeviantArt page. It's always a real good place you can go and check out the work that artists do, both pencilers, inkers, also color artists. So it's really a cool spot. So as I said, I hope that somebody steps up. I'd hate to see Artist Alley. I think it would hurt the Artist Alley there if it moved off of the exhibit floor.
The only good thing I would say about that is maybe they could definitely have more artists, but yeah, I don't think that would still be good for them in the end.
No, I don't think it would be good for them either. You know, we saw what taking the celebrities off of the floor at Phoenix Comic Con did to the Artist Alley there. So I think you need to have the Artist Alley and the place where a lot of foot traffic is, you need to keep them in the same place. I will agree with you. There would be a couple positives. You could have more artists and you could, it wouldn't be so crammed together. But yeah, I just don't think that moving it is the best choice.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing. San Diego's in a tough position. As I said, there's so many people that want to exhibit there and want to go, you know, both artists and publishers and just all, you know, you have the video games, you have the retailers, and there's only so much room on the floor. And honestly, you know, with the problems that San Diego's had, they were supposed to break ground this year on an expansion for that convention center. I think that would have been great. They've run into political problems and it's just a big fiasco. So who knows how long it'll take before, you know, something changes, but they really just need a convention center that's bigger. They just need a bigger, more exhibitor space. And it would solve a lot of their problems.
Yeah, it really does suck that whole expansion got pretty much denied by some political BS.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to take that area and increase it by 50%, they could sell more badges and they could have more exhibitors and more, you know, artists would be able to exhibit in Artist Alley. Although, man, I can't imagine how much worse Sunday would be at the end of the con when everybody leaves at once with another 50,000 people there. Because that's already, you know, one of the worst experiences I have every year.
Yeah, definitely.
Every other night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, there's other events that last, you know, past the time of when the exhibit floor closes. The exhibit floor usually closes at 7. There's lots of panels that happen. They're still going on into the night. There's cartoons being shown and movies being shown and just lots of other events going on. So not everybody leaves at once. People kind of trickle out. Some they'll leave earlier to go to an event, or they don't leave at 7 when the exhibit hall closes. They go upstairs to a panel, or they go do this, go do that, whatever, what have you. But Sunday at, I think it's usually 5 or 6. It closes a little earlier. I think it's 5 on Sunday.
I think it's 5 too.
Yeah, so 5 o'clock on Sunday, that's it. Everything is done. There's no more panels. There's no more movies being shown. There's no more events. So everybody that's there leaves at 5 o'clock. So you get this mass exodus of people and it seems crowded the other times, you know, when you leave, it always seems crowded in San Diego, but man, Sunday, everybody leaves. It is just such this huge mass of humanity, you know, all trying to move. And, you know, there's a street right there with, you know, so there's traffic lights and you can't cross. And oh man, it is just,
like I said, probably one of the worst times of the year for me every year is that. I don't know, this year we may just go and sit down somewhere until 5:30 or 6.
Yeah.
Go sit down and read some comics or do something. Hang out after it's already closed.
Mm-hmm.
Or press passes or something. I don't know. All right. Well, the next item of news that I want to mention just real quick is Secret Wars, the lateness of Secret Wars already. This just boggles my mind. Especially considering that Marvel has known, supposedly, ever since Jonathan Hickman started at Marvel, that they were going to have this Secret Wars event. You know, it's been planned for who knows how long, and already the first three came out on time, and now here we go with them being late.
Yeah.
I just don't get it. So Secret Wars 4 is 2 weeks late. It's now going to come out on the 1st of July. Secret Wars 5 is going to be 6 weeks late. It's not coming out till the 13th of August. And Secret Wars 6 is 3 weeks late, coming out on the 2nd of September. So,
that's insane.
And that would be bad enough, these three issues of Secret Wars. But because a lot of the other series that are going on that are tied into Secret Wars, they can't release those. Because they perhaps have spoilers or ruin, you know, the story or what's going on, what have you. So we've got, let me count here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 45 books. 45 books that are going to be anywhere from 1 to 4 weeks late being pushed back because Secret Wars is not on track. I'm sure a lot of these ones are done already. I'm sure a lot of the, you know, the series that are, you know, 2, 3, 4 issues, they're probably completely done.
Yeah.
And they're just being pushed back. And I gotta think that, you know, that can't exactly be easy on retailers. We've already talked about, how hard it is on retailers when they put the money out, you know, without knowing how the books are going to sell. We talked about it with Convergence. And the Convergence issues miniseries were only 2 issues long. So there's no way to know what, you know, how you have no way of knowing. You order your books 2 months in advance before you actually even see the first book, the series is over. You know, normally when a new series starts, you order X amount of number ones, and then, you know, you see how that sells, you see how number two sells. And so maybe by the time you're making your orders for issue 4, you kind of have an idea of where it's going to be at. Well, if the series only lasts 2 issues, you have no idea. Likewise, yeah. All these Secret Wars crossovers all starting at the same time. No real idea what's going to sell, what's not going to sell, or how long these miniseries are going to last, how many issues, because Marvel just hasn't said. Supposedly they're all listed as ongoings. None of them are listed as minis.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you're putting all this money out blind without knowing what the heck's going on. And now on top of that, now they're going to be late. So you've put your money, you've already placed your order with Diamond. You've paid your money for your order and you're waiting for it to come. You know? And the books don't show up until some of them 6 weeks later. You can't make money if you don't have the books to sell.
Yeah. The thing that boggles my mind is the fact that Secret Wars 5 is going to be 6 weeks late. I know for a fact that there are creators that could start right now and have a book out in less than 6 weeks. Like, I don't know how you don't anticipate that a book's going to be 6 weeks late before this point, like, especially with all of these books that are getting all, what'd you say, 42 or 45 books 45, that are getting
45.
Set back by it. Like, that's crazy to me. That's really somebody messed up pretty bad, or a lot of people messed up pretty bad, but well, I mean, that's crazy for six weeks is crazy.
Okay. So my guess is, that the artist fell behind.
Yeah.
So, and who is Ivan? Who's the artist on Secret Wars?
Is it Esad Ribic?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, Esad Ribic. So he falls behind. Right, it's gonna take him 2 weeks extra to do Secret Wars number 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means that. It's 6 weeks 6 weeks to do one issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that pushes the start time back on his Secret Wars 5 by 2 weeks. And then he figures it's going to take him 6 weeks to finish it.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But still, I mean, it's not like it's issue 10 or 11. I mean, these are issue 4 and 5. It's just, I know that there are creators or artists that are slow, but I feel like for a book that's this important for Marvel, they should have really made sure.
I agree that maybe they should have, you know. I mean, what was he doing? They should have had him starting a long time ago.
Yeah.
Also, the other thing they could be thinking is they for sure don't want any other delays.
Mm-hmm. So maybe they're giving him a little bit of extra cushion time to make sure that he gets caught up.
Right.
Yeah, I could see that.
Another thing to think about is this might not all necessarily be artist-related. There's been some talk lately of Marvel becoming the new DC, as it were. This has to do with the supposed or alleged editorial interference that a lot of the DC creators felt when the New 52 first started. Apparently, a lot of the creators over at Marvel are now experiencing the same thing. And it has everything to do with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, especially with Disney acquiring Marvel, there's a lot more eyes, I guess you'd say, on the comic work. And anything that the powers that be over at Marvel Cinematic or Disney, anything they see that they don't care for, it gets sent back. Change this, redraw this, they can't say that, rescript this, what have you. You know, they're constantly saying, oh, the movies don't have to match the comics, comics don't have to match the movies, whatever. But we see that the costumes change to match, we see that they want the heroes to be the same. I don't understand it. It really bothers me. I mean, personally, I love the old classic Captain America costume, and I think the new one looks stupid. There's no other way to say it. The pouches and whatever is supposed to look more realistic, I think it just looks stupid.
I think that the old costume in the comics was suited for the comics, whereas I don't mind his costume in the movies. I think it works fine just in the movies, but that's in the movies. But so why would you? I don't think that there should be any correlation with the costume between the two things. It's like when people draw characters in the books to look like the actors in the movies. I don't understand it either. It baffles me.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that the comic book costumes, the ones that appear in the comic books, necessarily translate to the big screen that well, so I have no problem with them changing them around for the movies, whatever. But, you know, Hawkeye's another prime example. You know, he had that classic costume, the purple and black or what have you, and, you know, now his costume looks like Jeremy Renner. They're the ones that say it doesn't have to be the same. But yet, we see things changing all the time because, you know, it's got to match up to the movies, So, you know, this could be another reason for some of the delays. You know, it was a hard lesson for DC to learn, and now it seems like they're taking a much less hands-on approach, you know, with this Divergence branding, this little mini relaunch or whatever you want to call it, with the 24, 25 new titles starting. They've kept their universe the same. It's not a reboot or a relaunch of the universe, but they're just launching not a lot of new titles with a lot of radical ideas. So, I don't know. Maybe Marvel has decided, or the powers that be at Marvel have decided that's not what they want to do. Personally, I think it's a mistake. I guess maybe we could see a lot of creators grumbling and a lot of creators maybe not last too long on their new books if it's any repeat of what happened with DC. I mean, a lot of these creators are, the rumors are that a lot of these creators, that these things are being sent back from these people they've never even heard of, you know, these executives that, you know, that don't necessarily work for, you know, they work for Marvel Studios, not necessarily Marvel.
Yeah.
And, you know, these characters, they want to keep them, you know, a certain way so they can appear in the movies, and they just, it seems like it would be a very hard environment to work under.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And finally, the last bit of news we're going to discuss is a few announcements from Aspen Comics, especially as it pertains to San Diego Comic-Con. They've got a couple new series starting. One of them is entitled Oniba, Swords of the Demon. It's going to be debuting at San Diego Comic-Con. It's set in Feudal Japan. It's by Paolo Pantalina and Vince Hernandez. And then they also have another series by David Wall, who a lot of people would know as the creator and writer of Witchblade, and veteran artist Giuseppe Cafaro. That one doesn't have a title yet, but the story supposedly centers on a young woman given a rare and powerful gift, and the gift turns out to be more dangerous than she expected. So we'll look forward to that. One thing I'm very excited about, finally, we're going to be seeing some Aspen t-shirts and some other apparel. So, you know, I've been anxiously awaiting an Aspen Comics t-shirt for years. Big fan of Michael Turner. My daughter is named Aspen. So they're finally going to have some Aspen t-shirts available for both men and women exclusively at the Aspen Comics booth. And also during their panel, they're going to reveal a sneak peek of a lot of other Aspen apparel and products. So we'll look forward to that. Oh, I should also mention that there's going to be a new string back tote bag also available at the booth. So, like I said, I've been anxiously awaiting an Aspen t-shirt for years. In fact, I've asked Aspen Comics panels in the past and was always told that they were coming. Basically just a matter of them having the time, setting aside the time to actually do it, because it wasn't something they wanted to farm out. They wanted to make sure it was done right. So, oh, and one other exclusive that Aspen's going to have, I mean, they'll have several other exclusives at San Diego, but one thing I want to point out is that they're going to be having a couple of hardbacks, highly limited, only 50 copies each. One of them is a hardback, hardcover edition of Michael Turner Presents Aspen, the Extended Edition by Jeff Johns and Michael Turner, and the Damsels in Excess hardcover edition by Vince Hernandez and Mirka Andolfo. So for those of you who are fans of Aspen Comics, limited only 50, so I hope you can get your hands on one if you can't get to San Diego. Hopefully they won't go for too crazy of prices on the secondary market. Mm-hmm. But I guess only time will tell.
Yeah, I'm interested. I have no idea anything about this Oniba Swords of the Demons, but I really like Paolo Pantalena's art. I think it's very good. I mean, I haven't really... There aren't very many Aspen books that don't look very good, but she definitely is... he's definitely a good artist.
Yeah, Aspen Comics have a tendency to look absolutely beautiful, and usually the letdown is story-wise. Recently, they've had the Four Points miniseries that was launched by Scott Lobdell, and no exception, art is outstanding. Story, it started out really, really strong. Issue 2 and 3 weren't quite as strong as the first issue, but it's been pretty good. So hopefully... with the apparel and some of these exclusive, Aspen can continue to grow. I mean, they kind of have their hardcore fan base. It'd be nice to see them expand a little more. I'd hate to see Michael Turner's legacy, disappear if Aspen were to, go under. Not that I know anything or that they're in trouble, but I know that they don't have a huge, market share. Don't hear too much critical acclaim for their books. I think everyone knows that, as I said, they're beautiful to look at, but oftentimes the story's a bit lacking, so it sure would be great to see them have another monster hit like their flagship book Fathom was when it first came out. It'd be, you know, really cool to have a property that really gained some more widespread readership in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
My name is Oliver Queen.
I'm gonna train you.
Use it.
There are other ways to see.
Houston are left behind.
My name is Barry Allen, and I am the fastest man alive.
Malcolm Merlyn, you have failed this city.
TV time! What do you got for us, Jaden?
Well, there's not a ton of news this week, but I think the biggest news is the casting for is the announcement that Punisher is going to be in the second season of Daredevil, and the casting is going to be John Bernthal, who was I forgot what his name was, but he in Walking Dead, but he was in the first and the second seasons of Walking Dead.
Shane, right? He played Shane.
Yeah, Shane, and. I'm actually pretty excited about this casting news. I could definitely see him as the Punisher. He books the part, and I think that he could play it. And hearing the Punisher is going to be in the second season of Daredevil just makes me hope that there will be a separate spin-off of Punisher, and it will have its own show on Netflix soon. And
sounds like your cat's pretty excited about the Punisher as well.
Yeah, and also there's also talk of Damian Dark being the main villain in the next season of Arrow, which I definitely could see that happening because of talk about him in the last season. Even Ra's al Ghul, or Ra's al Ghul, however you say it, in the was even scared of him last season, so that should be interesting.
Damian Dark, I don't even know who that is.
He supposedly, according to this article, he's another person in the another leader in the League of Assassins that used to be friends with Ra's al Ghul. There isn't a ton of information about it. I mean, I saw an interview with Stephen Amell talking about what he thinks is coming in season 4, and he said that every single season before this, he knew what the basic direction of the show was going to go into in the next season, but right now, this next upcoming season, he has no idea, he says. So, should be interesting.
Okay, so according to DC Wikia, Damian Dark was a mysterious, elusive, dangerous figure, claimed to be a major player in America's underworld, certainly had connection to the criminal organization Hive, seemed to have access to high-tech equipment, he was considered a major criminal by the CIA and FBI. However, their investigations revealed no hard evidence against him. He was a Wi-Fi fiend, staying in touch with associates by the latest forms of mass communication. What particularly baffled investigators was his apparent youth. He seemed to be in his early 20s, yet was already established and well-connected. Apparently, he was a foe of the Teen Titans, and he was shot to death by Vandal Savage. However, thanks to Addie's blood, which granted immortality, he survived. So genius-level intellect hasn't really appeared in too many DC books, only about 7 appearances. First appearance was Teen Titans number 1, March 1999. Last appearance, Titans 12, February 2000. So not a major character in the comics. So perhaps that's why they chose him, and they can kind of flesh him out. They don't have to worry too much about any kind of backstory or history that they have to kind of follow along or stay true to.
And also you mentioned Vandal Savage. Vandal Savage is going to be the main villain in the Legends of Tomorrow show, which I could definitely see how that, if he's friends or allies with Damian Dark, I could see how that would make the show's crossover quite a bit for the next season, kind of like Arrow and Flash crossed over this season.
True. And as far as Josh Bernthal, I definitely see the Punisher, not necessarily the Mike Zeck Punisher, but he definitely resembles the John Romita Jr. Punisher with kind of the broad face and the wide, flat nose. So I haven't watched any of the Daredevil series, but I just saw an article earlier today about how the Punisher and Daredevil have appeared on 23 covers of comics together. you know, they're both street level characters. You know, the Punisher obviously is much more violent than Daredevil, willing to kill. You know, there have been times where Matt Murdock's been kind of pushed to the edge. especially when Elektra was killed. He's been almost willing to take that next step, but they're definitely similar characters. And I think sometimes in the comics, it's been portrayed as Matt Murdock kind of sees the Punisher as kind of a warped reflection of himself, like, but for the grace of God, there go I. You know, Murdock, maybe if he just had made a couple decisions just a little bit differently or chosen just a slightly different path, he easily could have ended up on the wrong side of the law like the Punisher. So it's a very natural choice to have the Punisher appear in the next season of Daredevil.
Yeah, I think it's going to be cool, and I'm definitely looking forward to it. And the last piece of news and TV that I've got is Nicholas D'Agosta is going to become more of a regular on Gotham as Two-Face, which is interesting to me because he was in a few episodes of the last season, and I'm not sure I really liked his character that much, or at least the portrayal of it. It was more of like a bipolar take, because obviously it's Two-Face, but it's before he's had his accident where he became really a villain. He's still Harvey Dent, DA, and he just has these loud outbursts, and I'm hoping that the acting or the writing gets a little bit better for his character next season. But I'm a fan of the actor, and hopefully that ends up being pretty cool. Also, they're exploring the stories of Scarecrow and Hugo Strange, which I think is going to be cool, because this what they adventured in the Scarecrow's story in the first season, I've really enjoyed it. It was really interesting.
Jonathan Crane, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's already appeared just as Jonathan Crane?
Yes, but it was his, instead of like him being the one who made the gas, it was his father, and his father inflicted it upon his son.
Yeah, because the way it was. It is in the comics, or was in the comics. Well, anyway, that's the history in the at least the new 52 version of the Scarecrow. And as far as I know, it's like that in all the versions of the Scarecrow. Yeah, his father was, a research scientist researching fear, and yeah, he subjected his son Jonathan Crane to these fear toxins. So that he could study him. You know, it's not exactly approved for, human use or whatever, so that it could be studied. So he, took advantage of his own son. As far as Two-Face goes, didn't see any of it, but it just sounds like with these outbursts, they're showing that he has the capability to snap if something were to set him over the edge. Never been a big fan of Two-Face. He always seemed a bit cheesy to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scarecrow, I think, is a good Batman villain. Same with Hugo Strange. I do find it interesting, especially as it is in regards to Hugo Strange. I mean, guys like Genius Intellect, goes on these crime sprees or has these elaborate plans, and it's pretty much a battle of wits with Batman, but we know that Gotham is a story without Batman.
So I find it interesting they're bringing in these supervillains, and yet there's no Batman, especially because depending on how you look at the way Batman came to be, depending on what origin or what have you, I mean, he was kind of there at about the same time as these heroes or villains, I should say, or even before. Certainly that's the case in the Dark Knight trilogy by Christopher Nolan. In fact, that's, Commissioner Gordon's chief concern, that last scene on the roof there, I'm worried, you've escalated it by, wearing this costume and such, and now, look what we have here, and he shows them, the Joker playing card, and so that's certainly not the scenario that's playing out in the Gotham TV series, so very interesting.
Well, a lot of what I've seen in Gotham so far, it's not so much them and their full extent. Like, for example, in Scarecrow, it was when they showed it, they were trying to find the father of, what's Scarecrow's name? I can't think of it.
Jonathan Crane.
Yeah, Jonathan Crane. They're finding Jonathan Crane's father, and he was just trying to make a vial so his son would never have to be scared. That was his whole thing was because he had this really traumatic moment in his life that ruined his life, basically, that he said that he never wanted his son to have to feel that pain of being scared like that, but sadly, it didn't really work out like that. What he gave him really just put him in this perpetual state of fear, which set him into a scarecrow, which makes it interesting to me of how they're going to go about that, because it's, as of right now, he's only supposedly a teenager, like 14, 15 years old, who's been exposed to these things. I don't know. It'll be interesting. Definitely looking forward to the next season.
All right, now on to some movie news.
I know who I am! I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude!
What do you got for us, Jaden?
Well, so Sony and Marvel have got together and decided to put Spider-Man in their upcoming movies. I'm sure that anybody who's listening to this podcast knows that, but the casting actually is taking a lot longer than people are expecting, and for a long time they said that a kid named Asa Butterfield was going to get the role, but as of now it seems like that they're having a bit of a discrepancy between the two studios about the casting of Spider-Man, which I find it doesn't really surprise me, considering that Sony doesn't really want to. I doubt that Sony really wants Spider-Man to go into the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Disney, but they haven't really done very well with the previous Spider-Man movies, even the original three, maybe with Tobey Maguire. Those first two movies were decent, but after that, I don't think there's really been a good Spider-Man movie out, so I could definitely see the pressure that they feel under. But I'm guessing that Marvel Studios has tried to cast people for him, and a lot of the people they're trying to cast, Sony is vetoed, so.
You know, we know, and a lot of people were surprised by the fact that Sony was willing to let Marvel put Spider-Man in their movie, and they didn't charge them anything. You know, Sony has the agreement. They have the contract. They've licensed the character from Marvel. And we heard that Spider-Man was going to be back in the Captain America Civil War movie, and so everyone thought, okay, Marvel must have paid them some money to re-license their own character back. Come to find out, no, it's a handshake agreement. They are just going to let them use Spider-Man while Sony still retains the rights. And you have to think it's because the last two Spider-Man movies haven't done as well, especially Amazing Spider-Man 2 did nowhere near as well as Sony hoped it would do. So Marvel certainly seems to have the golden touch right now. So, okay, Sony's thinking, let's let Marvel put Spider-Man in their movie. They're Marvel. They seem to have the golden touch. They'll do it right. It'll raise the exposure. It'll raise people's desire for a Spider-Man movie. We can kind of see what Marvel does, kind of get a feel, a tone, and then we can go back and do our own Spider-Man, another relaunch of it, which, you know, seems incredible to me, you know, to relaunch that property again, but that's most likely what'll happen with whoever Marvel and Sony finally agree on to be this next Spider-Man. It seemed to me at one point the Asa Butterfield casting was kind of like a done deal.
Yeah, I definitely thought that he was going to be Spider-Man in the upcoming movie.
Yeah, and then, you know, he kind of dropped out or, you know, whatever happened. And then it said there were four other people, Tom Holland, Charlie Rowe, Matthew Lintz, and Charlie Plummer. But then the most recent news I heard just Friday, I think, was that it's been narrowed down to just two of those people. So, yeah, I'm sure the fact that Marvel and Sony both have to agree, that's probably what's, you know, causing the problems. And it also could be that Sony is not necessarily going to agree to cast a certain someone that Marvel wants unless
they know that they can sign that actor to a 2 or 3 movie deal to do a Spider-Man movies at Sony.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a big mess. You know, it's what happens when you license your characters back. Just about every day, any movie news that comes out regarding Marvel Cinematic Universe, especially, or Marvel characters, and news that comes out about Marvel characters who are at other studios like Fantastic Four, X-Men, Spider-Man, all I ever hear the fans clamoring for is, oh, please, Marvel, get the rights back to all your characters.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's certainly an interesting problem.
And in other news, there's a rumor of a Spider-Gwen movie in progress. And there's not any really solid evidence of this besides the fact that, Gwen Stacy is really blown up in the comic world right now, and there was somebody... a woman named Lisa Joy at Sony had something in mind to make a female Spider-Verse movie, and this was even like right after The Amazing Spider-Man 2 came out, so I'm guessing that maybe that either Sony had some inside information from Marvel that maybe this character was coming, or maybe they just came up with it all on their own, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a different Spider-type movie start or series start.
Let me ask you, this wasn't necessarily one of the things you talked about. How do you feel about Marvel Studios not being at San Diego Comic-Con this year?
I don't really mind them not being at San Diego Comic-Con. I mean, it's definitely weird that they're not going to be there. But me personally, I don't really enjoy their presence there as that much. I'm not so much about the movies there. I don't really go and do the Hall H thing, and I feel like the less there is of the big, huge movie studios there, the more there can be of comics. Not to say that I wouldn't want the comic movies to be there. In my opinion, those are really the only movies that should be there, but that's another thing altogether. I don't really mind it that much, but I mean, it is what it is. I understand it because Disney owns them, and Disney's going to have their own conventions and stuff, and they definitely want, and they want their own studios to be there.
They supposedly, now this is just a rumor that I heard, they supposedly knew early in the year that DC, Warner Brothers, was pulling out all the stops this year for San Diego Comic Con.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to have footage of Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. They're going to have footage of Suicide Squad, some content with Wonder Woman and Justice League Part 1. And when Marvel heard that, they just thought that DC's presentation was going to be a tough act to follow, and maybe they should just not even try to compete. Now, it's not uncommon in recent years for a lot of the big announcements for comic book companies to not actually happen at San Diego anymore, which is really weird because it's kind of like the Super Bowl for the comic mm-hmm. industry. But with the popularity and the rise in visibility of comics and comic properties in pop culture and mass media these days, there's so much noise that comes out of San Diego. I know a lot of companies decide, let's make our announcements the week before or the week after, just so it doesn't get lost in the shuffle. And I can certainly say, having attended San Diego the last 4 years, that when you're actually there, you hear even less news than people on the outside, because unless you're actually at the panel where the news gets announced, or know somebody, or, you know, happen to bump into somebody who's talking about it, there's just so much going on, and it's just overwhelming, and it's definitely hard to be noticed. You know, Marvel, last year, they waited till a few weeks after, then they announced Secret Wars and kind of explained what was going on with that. I mean, they're big enough now. Maybe a month after, in September or so, when they announced, here's our movie slate coming out, you know, for the next, you know, up through 2020 or whatever it was. I mean, they're big enough that they don't need the event of San Diego in order to make a big announcement. You know,
yeah.
They just announced, okay, we're going to have this big press conference and we're going to be talking about Secret Wars, and everybody's going to tune in. Everybody's going to show up. You know, they live stream it on the internet and it gets plenty of attention. They don't need the hoopla of San Diego Comic-Con. None of these big companies really do anymore. You don't need the big hoopla of San Diego Comic-Con in order to get your announcements noticed, because pop culture has become so focused on comics and comic book properties. But I do find it interesting, if there's any truth to it, you know, that they just didn't feel like they could compete with DC, you know, for people that are huge Marvel fans, and, you know, maybe this is their one chance to go to San Diego, and for Marvel Cinematic Universe to not even have a panel there, that's got to be disappointing. I mean, it's not like their output for 2016 is lacking. You know, they've got Captain America Civil War. They've got Doctor Strange. And I know that they said that they just barely started with filming Captain America Civil War. They wouldn't have any footage ready till August. Doctor Strange is still in pre-production, but they brought footage of Captain America First Avenger and Guardians of the Galaxy when those movies were only a couple weeks into filming. So you just kind of, you know, you kind of wonder. Now, I know last year they had the cast of Avengers Age of Ultron there, and Tom Hiddleston, is that how you say his name?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, Loki, he basically took over the panel and kind of hosted it himself. They also had the whole cast for Ant-Man there. They had the cast from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. there. So it's just going to be, it's weird that they're not going. Whatever the reason being, it's just weird that they're not going. That being said, you know, Disney owns Marvel. You know, I'm sure it was their decision. And they also own Star Wars now. They bought that from Lucasfilms. And there's going to be no shortage of Star Wars panels and Star Wars events and Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars. There's something like 6 Star Wars panels, a huge Star Wars presentation in Hall H. So, you know, maybe Disney just decided that's where we're going to put our focus. And, you know, much like DC with the Green Lantern movie a few years ago, I've said this before, they put on a huge push at San Diego Comic-Con for Green Lantern, and the movie still flopped.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of the publishers and these movie studios that are creating these comic book movies realized is San Diego Comic-Con is not the place you need to go to promote your movie, because that's kind of your captive audience. Comic book fans are going to go see comic book movies regardless of whether you promote it at San Diego or not. So maybe your advertising budget and your energy is best spent elsewhere rather than, you know, promoting it to comic fans who are most likely going to go anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe Marvel realizes, you know, we're popular enough, we've had enough success at this point that we can kind of do whatever we want to do, and people are going to show up. That's certainly how it seems with the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, you know, one of the highest grossing movies of the year last year, kind of catapulted Chris Pratt into superstardom. You know, comic readers can sit there and tell me, oh yeah, I knew who the Guardians of the Galaxy were before that movie came out. Yeah, right. They were second tier, third tier characters, you know, second tier at best, you know, more accurate, you know, say third or fourth tier. And people didn't know who they were. They just didn't. But they had faith because Marvel had done such a good job putting out these movies, so they went and saw, you know, then word of mouth, and the movie caught fire, and now, you know, maybe that's part of it. Maybe Marvel just feels like, hey, we don't need to go and have a big presence and drum up publicity. We can pretty much put out any movie and say it's Marvel Cinematic Universe, and, you know, our fans are going to come and see it. And that well may last, may continue to be that way until they mess up and put out a Green Lantern or a Howard the Duck, you know, something that's just terrible, and you know, then the fans feel betrayed.
Yeah, so. I could see what you're saying with Marvel not being there, but I would be really surprised if they weren't there next year, showing off stuff for Infinity War, because I feel like Civil War, and the Captain America Civil War, is going to be a huge part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I'm not so sure that there's a lot of stuff that they could show off for that. I feel like there's going to be a lot of, it's going to be one of the Marvel movies that isn't shown a lot of. Like, for Age of Ultron, there were a lot of spoilers out before the movie even came out of who was gonna, what was basically gonna happen. And I feel like, they're gonna try to keep that a lot more under wraps with the Civil War.
Yeah, that could be true. That could be true. You know, a lot of people are calling Captain America Civil War Avengers 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we'll see. Now, if Marvel does come back in 2016 to San Diego, you think that lends any credibility to the story that they just didn't want to go up against DC's, supposed huge lineup of stuff?
No, I really feel like that Marvel at this point does not care what anybody else is doing besides themselves. I mean, maybe they look at it a little bit, but I think at this point their movies are just so big that people are going to go see them regardless of DC, how good DC movies look.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing the rumor too. I mean, Marvel's kind of kicked their butt all over the place as far as the big screen goes. And yeah, I have a hard time, I mean, maybe they just, I could see it from the point of view is, okay, you know, none of our stuff for 2016 is far enough along that we really have much to show. And, you know, it'll be underwhelming for our fans. So, you know, and DC's, you know, gonna have all this stuff and it's gonna make ours seem even more underwhelming. And so let's not go. I could see it from that point of view, but yeah, as far as them like being worried, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, these are panels that last a couple hours and, you know, get a lot of fans saying, "Oh my God," on the internet, you know, and really when it's all said and done, it really doesn't matter. When the movie comes out, how well the movie does, how well the movie's received, you know, at the end of the day, that's what really matters. And until DC puts out a awesome comic movie that can really, you know, compete with Marvel as far as having a cohesive universe and, you know, a strong, good central focus, then I don't know that Marvel really needs to worry. And as I said, you know, Marvel's owned by Disney, Star Wars is owned by Disney. It could, you know, could have come down from Disney. Hey, let's focus this year on Star Wars.
Yeah.
Did you hear that Jurassic World had the biggest opening weekend ever with $500 million this weekend?
I did not, actually.
Yeah, did $200 million, a little over $200 million in the U.S. and over $300 million worldwide or in foreign markets for a total of a little over $500 million. But I have a feeling that Star Wars will beat that, although I don't know that Star Wars is opening everywhere at the same time like Jurassic World did this weekend. But I fully expect by the end of the year for Star Wars to be the highest grossing movie of all time.
Yeah, I would not be surprised at all. I would actually be surprised if it wasn't. But it's pretty crazy about Jurassic World. It just supports how fast Chris Pratt's rise to stardom has been.
Yeah, and plus, it's nostalgia for a lot of people, you know, those people that were much like Chris Pratt himself, you know, 7 to 15 age group or whatever when Jurassic Park came out. I mean, that was a pretty big cultural event when it came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're all, you know, adults now and, you know, with kids of their own. And it's not a crazy superhero movie. It's not crazy violent. It's just, you know, looks like kind of a good traditional summer popcorn blockbuster special effects movie. And it really drew a lot of people. So we discussed a few rumors there actually in the movies, but may have one or two more.
That's the rumor.
So let's talk about a couple comic book rumors. The rumor coming out of Marvel is that Jeff Lemire, who recently signed an exclusive with Marvel, yet still can do work for Valiant and still has his creator-owned stuff. So I guess basically it's just a exclusive with Marvel that says you can't work at DC, but you can do your creator-owned whatever, what have you. Anyway, the rumor is that he's going to be taking over as kind of the lead writer of the X-Books coming out of Civil War. So that certainly is interesting. He hasn't ever really done much traditional superhero work. I know he was one of the writers on the second half of New 52 Future's End. You know, he had his Sweet Tooth series over at the DC Vertigo line. So it'll be interesting to see, especially with the rumors that the mutants are all going to be off-planet at the end of Secret Wars. Supposedly the Inhumans, the Terrigen gas that was released is fatal to mutants, so they'll have to leave the Earth. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation that, much like with the Fantastic Four disappearing from all, from everything Marvel, you know, the series has come to an end. They've canceled a bunch of licenses. They even contracts they had with companies to put out statues and toys or whatever, they pulled those contracts. And so it seems like perhaps they want to take the Inhumans and kind of use them to replace the X-Men in the main Marvel universe once again, because Marvel doesn't have the rights to their own property of X-Men. And we've seen the Inhumans show up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and Marvel seems to be pushing the Inhumans right now with the Inhumans movie plan down the line. You know, once again, second, third tier characters at best that Marvel seems to be trying to elevate at the expense of the X-Men. So Jeff Lemire is a good writer. If he indeed is given this challenge to remove the X-Men, kind of separate them out from the rest of the Marvel Universe, it'll be interesting to see what he does. One thing that was also mentioned was that perhaps that it might be where you'd want to work if you were working for Marvel right now, because you wouldn't have that interference. You wouldn't have those higher-up executives at Marvel Studios looking over your shoulder, because the X-Men aren't going to appear in any Marvel movies, so what does it matter to them? So that may, in fact, be the best place to be. And as I said, the Marvel editorial interference, those rumors are running rampant right now. And I guess only time is going to tell. And I don't know that it'll ever be to the extent we saw at DC. Marvel seems to pay close attention to DC, and especially DC's mistakes, and kind of is able to avoid making the same ones. As much as they claim not to pay attention, they really do. And you know, they should.
Definitely don't need two companies making the same mistakes.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like with this editorial interference, they could be heading that direction, but hopefully they'll learn from the mistakes DC made, and perhaps they'll be able to turn it around sooner, or at least I don't think it'll play out so publicly. Another rumor I heard recently was that the contracts that Marvel is making all their creator sign, I mean, it could be the smallest thing. You're going to do a little 8-page story as a backup, and it's going to appear in a Marvel book. You're going to have to sign a contract. The contract states you're not going to say anything bad about Marvel, about any of their properties, about any of their movies, any of their TV shows. Nothing. You can say nothing negative, like, for the rest of your life, apparently.
That rumor's true. I'd be very surprised. That's crazy.
Yeah, and you know, this information comes from a creator who worked for Marvel back in the 70s, and Marvel was going to put out a collection of Captain Marvel books. This would be the old Captain Marvel, Marvel, the Kree Captain Marvel from back in the day. And being that 8 of the 12 books or 8 of the 10 books or whatever that were in this collection were all written by this one writer, they asked him if he'd want to do the introduction for it. And he said, oh, sure, you know, whatever. And they sent him this contract, and it had all this language in there. You know, I'll never say anything bad about Marvel, blah, 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 blah. And he was like, I'm not signing this. This is, you know, ridiculous. I'm doing a little, you know, 2-page, you know, introduction or whatever. And so they took some of the language out or whatever, and he still wasn't happy. And he's like, look, can't I just get a contract that says you're going to pay me X amount of dollars, I'm going to give you a 2,000-word essay, and that's going to be it. And Marvel basically said, no, we don't do that. That's not how we operate. So certainly seems like since, you know, Disney's taken them over, they've gone very corporate, let's say. That's a very corporate attitude, you know, cover your butt and really, it really, in my opinion, hamstrings the creative process. I certainly wouldn't sign a contract like that.
Yeah, definitely.
I've spent my entire life doing nothing but collecting comic books. And now there's only time to say, life well spent!
Alright, Jaden. I guess it's time to see how well you paid attention when you were reading The Valiant from Valiant Comics. So I've got three questions here. The first question is, what is the item Bloodshot is sent to retrieve in issue one called? A, the box. B, the cube. C, the package. Or D, the collection.
Wow, you went real technical on this one.
They say it like 6-7 times in the first issue.
I'm sure they do, but I'm leaning towards A, the box. Because I'm pretty sure that's what they called it at towards the end when they opened it up.
Nope. I will tell you that at the end when they opened it up, they were referring to it as the crate.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't put that in as one of the choices for exactly that reason. I didn't want to have any confusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Forgot that one. So...
The box.
What were the answers again?
The box. The cube, the package, the collection.
All right. Of those three that are left, that are, I think it's the cube of those three.
It's the package.
Yeah, I do not. I don't remember that at all, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Number two. What is the identity from K's deepest fear that the immortal enemy takes on in issue number two? Is it A, the demon, B, Mr. Flay, C, Dr. Evil, or D, Shadow Master?
See, this one was, you went a little bit easier on this one. It was Dr. Flay, right? Or Mr. Flay?
Mr. Flay, ding, 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 ding. All right, finally, the package can only be opened by one person. Who is it? A, Bloodshot. Oh, yeah. B, Galad the Eternal Warrior. C, Rai. D, Exo Manowar.
I'm going to go with B, the Eternal Warrior, Galad.
Ding, 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 ding. You got two out of the three. Man, I thought that first one was so easy.
Yeah, I didn't really pay attention to it.
Yeah, kind of a minutia thing. I mean, they just kept calling it the package, you know, all throughout the first issue, the package. So I thought, yeah, I guess it just didn't stick.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the miniseries, though. The Valiant is a really good read.
Yeah, did the ending surprise you?
A little bit, actually, yeah. Because I know that when Valiant kills people in their universe, they stay dead.
They did spoilers!
Hey, I'm not saying who they killed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Does it make you want to read Bloodshot Reborn?
Yeah, it does, actually. I'm very curious to where his character is going at this point.
Yeah, Bloodshot Reborn has been very good. This coming Wednesday, the 17th of June, will be issue 3 is going to come out. So, anxiously awaiting that.
Please do note, this is no ordinary comic book. It is in permanent condition. If you spill soda on it, the drops fly off harmlessly onto lesser comic.
And now for our top of the stack segment. This is where Jane and I talk about a comic that has recently risen to the top of our stack. Something we just couldn't wait to read. And for me, this last week, the comic I could not wait to read was Palmiotti and Brady's The Big Con Job, issue 4 from Boom Studios. Jimmy Palmiotti and Matt Brady, as writers, teamed up to do a 4-issue limited series from Boom Studios called The Big Con Job. It's basically the story of a heist, and just like last week with the Tithe from Top Cow, written by Matt Hawkins, you know, much the same. I'll say it again. I'm a sucker for a good heist story. So it's kind of a play on words. The Big Con Job. You know, they're pulling a heist. They're pulling a con. But it's actually at a con. They're robbing the San Diego Comic-Con, of millions of dollars in cash, apparently. They've taken the liberties. I'm sure that there's not you know, millions of dollars in cash, especially not from the convention itself. You know, maybe if you took all the cash on the floor from all the different vendors, you know, maybe you could scrape together a significant amount of money, but you know, that you don't buy your badges there. You certainly don't pay for them in cash. And so, you know, there's not a big stash of cash to be stolen from San Diego Comic-Con. So don't go out and buy all four issues of the Big Con Drop thinking that it's a blueprint for how to rob a convention. That being said, do go out and buy the Big Con Job because it's a great story. It's just a lot of fun. The art by an artist named Domo Stanton was very well done. A little caricature, a little stylized with the different characters. And it just is a lot of fun. It starts out, it's not exactly an upbeat story. We meet a lot of characters who, let's just say they're past their prime. You know, they work the con circuit. They go to these conventions and they sign autographs for fans. Their days of being Hollywood stars, or, you know, to use that term loosely, stars are really behind them. You know, they're not in demand. They're not being asked to, you know, still do projects and what have you. And for some of them, this is their only income, and they, you know, they've been marginalized to some extent. And they have to stoop to, you know, scraping by, signing these autographs and selling these 8x10 pictures and such. And so they really feel like they're at a place in their lives where really maybe they need to take this chance and go ahead and take this offer they're presented with, this opportunity they're presented with to rob San Diego Comic-Con. But the book finishes on a much more upbeat note, and as I said, if I could use one word to describe the story, the book, it would just be fun. It's just a really fun story. I could definitely see that it's relevant with the popularity of comics these days, and I could see that the position that these characters are in is, you know, a very realistic one, and just a great read. I mean, Jimmy Palmiotti is one of my favorite writers, and I found the series to be so good that if him and Matt Brady were to team up to do something else, I for sure would check it out. So, The Big Con Job from Jimmy Palmiotti and Matt Brady, issue 4, I couldn't wait to see how it all turned out, was definitely at the top of my stack this last week.
And this week I've been really, I got caught up on Postal, another book by, well, a book by Matt Hawkins, and Isaac Goodhart does the art, and I would not describe this book as fun.
Well, don't forget, Matt Hawkins has a co-writer on the book, Brian Edward Hill.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it focuses on the main character, whose name is Mark Shifron, who has Asperger's, and it's his life in this fictional town called Eden, Wyoming. It's basically a town where criminals go to live a normal life, basically, and it's run by criminals, and it's he as the postman, and it just shows his life in this town, and it's definitely a very interesting story, and it's kind of cool to see a different take on the you really only see the negative effects of like disorders like Asperger's and stuff like that, but it really focuses on like how Mark Shifron has a knack for certain things. Like he can really know, he can notice what somebody smells like and remember what they smell like. And, or if he smells somebody, let's say, and they're in a mask, he would be able to tell who that is if he smelled that person at some point before. And it's definitely a really interesting book. The art's, fits really well. I think that the storytelling is amazing. I can't, recommend this book enough.
Yeah, and you said that it's criminals trying to lead a normal life in this town, so they
go. Well, kind of. It's just like this town that was founded by criminals, and it seems like a really normal town except for a few small things. Like there's on one of the issues, they find a body laying in the middle of the street, and they don't understand why there's this body here. And obviously, it's not as safe as a regular town, and it's not going to be completely normal, but it is a criminal town that where people are trying to at least live a decent life.
But in a way, isn't it safer than a regular town? I mean, they don't actually allow any crime, right?
Yeah, that is true, but the way that they don't allow crime isn't perhaps the safest way. It's kind of run by the main character's mom. She's the mayor, and she kind of does whatever she needs to do to keep the town safe and
off, it's off the radar of law enforcement.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So you got nowhere else to turn. You know, you can't go into witness protection. It's kind of like witness protection for criminals. You go to this town.
Yeah, pretty much.
Kind of disappear.
Mm-hmm.
By living in this town, get a new identity, and as long as you don't commit any crimes or call any attention to the town, you're allowed to stay there, live there.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, I almost picked that from my top of the stack last week, so I definitely agree with your choice. And something that I've heard a lot of people say, even Matt Hawkins himself, I've heard a lot of people recommend this as a comic to give to somebody who says they don't like comics or is not a comic reader, wants to become a comic reader, or just wants to see what all the hubbub is about comics, because it's definitely not a, you know, a traditional comic book story with either zombies or supernatural stuff or superheroes or aliens or sci-fi. It's a real down-to-earth kind of story. Almost, you could almost say maybe a Twin Peaks kind of noirish TV show type story. So would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I think it would actually make a great TV show. The way that the books are set out, it would really be interesting. It's an amazing story. I mean, it has nothing to do with superheroes, nothing to do with any supernatural anything. It's just really compelling. It's flawlessly written, I believe.
All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us on the second episode of the Comic Source Podcast. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with us, you can go to our website, thecomicsourceblog.com, find all our podcast episodes there. You can see my YouTube videos there. You can check out the sketch gallery. You can check out Manny's blog. You can also get in touch with us through the website. Just click on the Contact Us link, or you can comment directly on the podcast episode on the individual pages. If you'd like to email us directly, our email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can like us on Facebook. Just do a search for The Comic Source, that's us. And of course, we have a Twitter as well, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Love to get feedback from you guys. Let us know what we're doing that you like, what we're doing that you don't like. If you have a book you want to recommend, if you have a book you want us to review, don't hesitate, reach out and let us know. Upcoming here in the next couple weeks, gonna have a big prep for Comic-Con episode. There is a San Diego Comic-Con group on Facebook that I'm a member of. A lot of first-timers, a lot of people that have only been once before. Maybe it's their first time going, or their first time going for 4 days. A lot of questions, so Jane and I are gonna go down the list of a lot of those questions and attempt to answer as many of them as we can. We'll give some advice from the things we've learned over our years of going to San Diego Comic-Con, how to prepare, what to expect, what to be sure you remember to bring, and things like that. So look forward to that episode. It'll be both a YouTube episode and a podcast episode. So once again, we want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Later.